From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Hold on for this ride. Later tonight, a psychic looks at the world. Here's what's happening. Well, another slap in the face to America. Yet another American company is aiming to move its headquarters out of the country. Adios. International food company Burger King says it will pay about $11 billion to buy Canadian chain Tim Hortons, which sells coffee, donuts, and other breakfast food fare. The deal would merge America's second-largest burger chain, which is valued at nearly $10 billion, with the Canadian equivalent to Dunkin' Donuts, which is valued at more than $8 billion. It would also move the new company's headquarters to Canada, where corporate taxes are significantly lower. Let's check in with investment advisor Catherine Austin Fitz. This has been going on, Catherine, and I don't think it's going to stop.
Well, inversions have been going on a long time, but they've accelerated over the last year, George, and there are a couple reasons. One is the pressure on corporations to generate earnings is tremendous, and the U.S., our corporate tax rate is higher than the average in the OECD nations and the rich ones, and we have tremendous number of loopholes, so corporations often pay less. And so there's a real pressure to kind of align tax policies across the different nations. But the other thing is, you know, we've been shipping dollars abroad, and now investors want something real for their money, just not more paper. But I would point out that the majority ownership, 66% of the stock, was bought at Burger King in 2010 by a Brazilian investment company and their investors. So, you know, Burger King has been international for quite some time, but particularly since the Brazilians have controlled it now for a couple of years. So, you know, so there's a deeper story here.
We've got millions of Canadian listeners, Catherine. They listen to us every night.
Uh-huh.
They're great neighbors to the north, and this is great.
Right, and they love Tim Hortons.
They do. So this is great news for them, not good news for America. What could we do as a country to be competitive to keep some of these companies at home? Here's an example. A lot of states are so competitive, they'll offer corporations to move from one state to another and give them tax breaks. Why aren't we doing that to keep corporations here in the United States rather than move out?
Well, corporate taxes has come down steadily. In fact, I would argue that corporations are taking out a lot more and putting in a lot less if you look at what's happened historically with taxes. But part of this is, you know, when we created the Uruguay round and the WTO in the 90s, George, we started to let capital flow in a way that corporations could play sovereign governments off each other. And so what you're seeing is that policy needs to be aligned across different jurisdictions if it's going to make any sense. And it's a struggle politically because, at this point, without campaign reform, I dare say the corporations have a lot more clout with the legislatures in Washington. So I think it's really incumbent, particularly during the election, for citizens and consumers to say, look, if you're going to, you know, we're not going to patronize you unless you're a good, if you're a good citizen in this place. And so the real question is not who owns it or where's the headquarters. Is this company being a good citizen and paying its fair share within a place? That's the big question.
Track Catherine, her website, solari.com. Catherine, thank you so much. If you live in California and you buy a new phone starting in July of next year, 2015, all smartphones in California will be required to have a kill switch, which means if you lose your phone or if it's stolen, you can kill that phone. It won't work to the thief who took the phone. That's what they're going to do. Now, if your phone shows up sometime, there'll be a way that you can get it turned back on again. You'll be the lucky one. But that's what they're going to do in California. President Barack Obama has yet to decide whether to authorize airstrikes against the ISIS targets now in Syria, not Iraq, but Syria. More and more, though, the signals from the administration and the military suggest such a campaign could be coming. So we're already bombing Iraq to try to take care of ISIS, but of course they're also in Syria, and we want to hit them. And Assad, President Assad of Syria, has said there's no way you're going to bomb Syrian soil, so let's see what happens there. Egypt has brokered an agreement on a long-term ceasefire between Israel and Palestinian militants in Gaza. The Hamas negotiators said that the deal should end the 7 weeks of fighting that has left more than 2,200 people dead. The Palestinians said Israel had agreed to ease its blockade of Gaza to allow in aid supplies and building materials. The Ebola virus has the upper hand in an outbreak that has now killed more than 1,400 people in West Africa, according to a top American health official, adding that experts have the tools to stop it. Dr. Tom Frieden, the director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, is visiting Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, the three hardest hit countries. The World Health Organization estimates that in those three countries alone, only 1 to 2 doctors are available to treat 100,000 people. Listen to this one. A private fertility clinic in the United States has launched an investigation into the health of 17 teenagers who were born as a result of a controversial IVF technique that produced the world's first 3-parent embryos more than 15 years ago. The technique, which the U.S. government stopped back in 2002, involved mixing the eggs of 2 women so that the resulting IVF babies in vitro inherited genetic material from 3 individuals in a similar process to that planned in Britain for women carrying maternally inherited mitochondrial disorders. It's an amazing story. Are we altering Mother Nature too much? Let's check in with the genius of the beast author, Howard Bloom. Howard, this is a strange, strange story.
It's a strange story, but it is remarkably hopeful. There is an extremely bizarre genetic modification process that we use that's tremendously risky, and it gives birth to a lot of kids who are retarded, a lot of kids who are sometimes kids who are missing a limb. It produces all kinds of devastating results, and that genetic modification technique is called sex. And one of the results of normal sexual reproduction, the stuff that nature has given us, is that there are several hundred what are called mitochondrial diseases. Mitochondria are tiny little power plants in every cell of your body. And if those power plants are misfiring, if they're not operating properly, not only are your cells in big trouble, you're in big trouble. You can have the equivalent of epileptic seizures. You can have what look like strokes. You can lose the use as a young person, as a person 20 years old. You can lose the use of your hearing. You can lose your sight. It's a terrible thing to have. So a cell is like a plastic bag with a big plastic bag filled with water with a baseball in the middle. And the mitochondria are little flecks. They're in the water. They're in the soup of the cell. And if they go haywire, terrible things happen, and there is no cure whatsoever. So if a woman suspects that she is carrying a mitochondrial illness, but she still wants to have children, what she can do is go to an in vitro fertilization clinic and ask them to do something called cytoplasmic transfer. In other words, the researchers, the scientists, will take a tiny amount of the mitochondria from another woman's egg and put it into the egg of the woman who is carrying a mitochondrial disease to make sure that all of her kids end up with healthy mitochondria. It doesn't touch the nucleus. The nucleus has the 22,000 genes that make you you and that will make your kids somewhat, although not entirely, similar to you. And it doesn't change the membrane, that wall, that plastic bag around the cell. It only changes those tiny little flecks that are power plants. And those tiny little flecks are so small, they only have 37 genes, whereas your nucleus has 22,000 genes. That's a big difference. So there's a question that was raised by one of the writers writing about this topic, and that is this the use of this technique going to increase the amount of suffering in the world or decrease it? And the answer is it's going to decrease it. So it is a good thing.
So you don't think it's a Dr. Moreau situation?
No, not at all. Remember, back in 1969, there was a poll taken that indicated that Americans were scared stiff of in vitro fertilization. They thought it was a Dr. Strangelove or a Frankenstein.
Sure. And you have 8 babies and things like that.
Right. And today, there have been millions of children born that way, and we're better off.
All right, Howard, always like your perspective on things. Howard Bloom. The World Health Organization says there should be a ban on the use of e-cigarettes indoors and that the sales to children should stop as well. In a report, the health body says that there must be no more claims that the devices can help smokers quit until there is firm evidence to support this. Well, in a moment, the oil card, global economic warfare in the 21st century. What do you think the battle in Iraq is all about? Think about that. In a moment, James Norman joins me on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. So the next time you fill up your car, just think about, hey, where did this come from? What's the price I'm paying? Is it higher or lower than what I paid last week? Lots of things going on in the world of oil. Jim Norman, veteran business journalist, energy reporter, contributing writer for McGraw-Hill's Platts Oil Graham News, senior writer for at least 10 years before retiring back in 2007, noted author, The Oil Card, Global Economic Warfare in the 21st Century. He was on with me a couple years ago, and James, the oil just keeps on pumping, doesn't it?
Yes, it doesn't stop. There's plenty of it, and the price doesn't come down either.
No, they play amazing. Those little games, James. You know, they drop it a little bit, and you think, oh, my gosh, this is a deal. And then it goes right back up again. I mean, yeah. I don't know. What changes it? Why do the prices fluctuate, but they really never drop?
Well, this is what's been quite interesting to me. I've followed this for a long time, writing about the oil business, and particularly lately. You know, the price of a barrel of oil traded on the New York Mercantile Exchange, it's hovered in this $100 barrel range for about 4 years now. It really hasn't moved much at all. Price of gasoline has hung in there right around that $4 mark, despite all the world turmoil. It's amazing, in a way, how calm oil prices have been over that period, which, to me, just makes the point I've been trying to explain to people for years now, that these oil prices are really not a function of actual physical supply and demand for the oil. There's something else going on here. Oil prices are being managed on a global basis, really for geopolitical purposes, and the U.S. has the ability to do that. We've proven that. We've shown it. And it's particularly important right now because of all the stuff going on between Russia and Ukraine, Iraq, and with China.
Well, you know, let's talk a little bit about all of this, James, including, of course, our talk on peak oil. I have long been an abiotic oil theorist. I believe that the planet, when it was formed, had enough of this stuff, whatever it is, that we call oil now, and that it doesn't come from plankton or dead dinosaurs or anything like that. Now, there's some people who back that up. There's some people who say, no, nonsense. We're going to run out of oil. It's going to peak. And it does come from fossil fuels, you know, from plants and animals. I just can't believe we have pumped so much oil out of this planet from plankton and dinosaurs. I can't believe it.
Well, that's right. I mean, it's not really a fossil fuel. It's hydrocarbons, but the hydrogen doesn't come from dead dinosaurs. The hydrogen comes from deep in the earth. The earth is like a giant grinding mill deep inside. It's continually grinding away and creating gases that are venting towards the surface all the time, including hydrogen, from which when hydrogen comes in contact with carbon, you get hydrocarbons. And if you cook them long enough, they end up in long chains. And if you trap them in a rock that's got porous openings in it, then you get an oil reservoir. And the science is definitely going your way, George, because we're drilling wells now at tremendous depths and still finding lots of liquid hydrocarbons down there. And I think it's because as these hydrogen molecules move towards the surface, they combine with carbon and you get hydrocarbons. That's my theory. I guess we're all entitled to a theory. But definitely, the Earth is manufacturing this stuff and storing it, and the Earth's crust is not about to run out of oil anytime soon.
I don't think so. Doesn't mean we should be using it, probably, but you know, I do think it's coming from the planet. Now, what do you think its original intent? Because I'm one of those believers too, James, that when the Creator did whatever had to be done, everything has a purpose on this planet, in this solar system, in this universe. There's no flukes here. Everything's got a purpose. What's the purpose of this oil inside of the planet? What's it supposed to be doing for the planet?
Well, I guess to get metaphysical about it, you know, one of the names for the ancient Hebrew god Yahweh was the God that provides. And he does.
But he
makes you work for it sometimes.
So you're thinking that the purpose of oil in the planet isn't to, you know, keep the tectonic plates greased up or anything like that. It's for us.
It's a gift, absolutely. I think it's a gift. I mean, modern society just would not exist without liquid fuels. You know, we'd still be back in the Stone Age, really. It was the advent of powerful, transportable liquid fuels that has really made industrial life possible and all the wealth creation that comes with that.
But you don't see, I want to get this clear, you don't see oil as benefiting the planet as a structured planet. There's no need for it to really be used by that planet.
No, I think it's a gift there to be had, to be responsibly used. And there's no virtue in leaving it in the ground unless you want to jack the price up.
Yeah, exactly. Or convince people you're going to run out, right?
Well, that's part of it. You know, this whole peak oil thing, it's 80% propaganda, really, and it's been around a long time. It kind of comes and goes. Depends on what kind of pricing policies the government is trying to push at any given time.
Well, James,
back in the 1980s, the U.S. government was trying to drive down the price of oil to bust the Soviet Union, which we did.
At that time,
there was a whole flurry of propaganda at that time about how much oil was in the ground. All of the Middle East countries all went around increasing their reserve estimates. The official wisdom from Wall Street was, oh, don't buy oil stocks. You know, there's a glut of this stuff. You know, and so, you know, these mantras kind of come and go. And right now, I think the government is still trying to push this oil scarcity thing as part of its effort to keep the price of oil up, which is like trying to keep a lead balloon in the air. Because all commodities tend toward glut if you let them go that way. And oil is just like that. The biggest problem the oil industry has is not getting oil out of the ground. It's how to keep enough of it in the ground so you don't trash the price structure.
Right, exactly. At what point do the peak oil people give in and say, you know what, we were wrong? I mean, because this has been going on for years. Another 10 years, another 20. Where's that point, James, where they simply say, my God, we're still pumping. We're wrong.
Well, I think that point has actually already come. You just don't hear as much screaming about this as you did even a couple of years ago. I think it's died down a lot because it should be evident to anybody that the world has plenty of oil, that even with half of the countries in OPEC are in some kind of crisis and can't produce what they should be producing, still, the world has plenty of oil. Nobody is really running out of oil. You got to pay a high price for it, but supply and demand are very evenly matched now.
I would guess that there's enough oil to match the oceans on the surface of this planet. What do you think?
Well, that's an interesting thought. It's possible when you consider that the oceans really are a very, very thin layer on the surface of the earth. It could be that there are more hydrocarbons than there is H2O in the planet. It's possible. It's an interesting concept, possible. But I mean, still, you got to work hard to get oil out of the ground. You got to drill wells. You got to drill very deep. Now we figure out how to drill wells horizontally for miles and then go in and crack the rock so that the oil flows through them. So technology is just relentless, and it's bringing more and more and more oil on. But you still, you're spending a couple of $1 million now for one well to produce maybe 1,000 barrels a day.
James, when we come back, I want to talk with you about the situation in Iraq. It's one of the world's largest reserves for oil. And guess what ISIS wants? And guess what we want? We'll be back. Welcome back. James Norman with us for a couple hours as we talk about energy and oil. So, James, the fight for Iraq. I'm convinced when we went in there the first time, it was for the oil. And I'm convinced now it still is. We are not going to let ISIS take over all those oil plants and reserves, are we?
Yeah, that's right. It's the oil. It's the oil, stupid, I guess. It's a paraphrase, James Carville. but let me give you a little bit broader perspective here.
Okay.
Where I'm coming from with this. We're really involved in a much bigger economic war. And it's a global war. It's particularly the United States against China. And in that regard, oil pricing and availability are a key weapon. We want to slow those guys down. We're not going to stop them, but we can slow them down. And eventually they're going to run out of time. And I think that is the U.S. strategy. Now, one way you slow them down is to raise their costs of doing business. The Chinese desperately have to import oil. They import more oil than we do as a percentage of their total usage. In fact, they are now importing more barrels a day than we are. So they're vulnerable to higher oil prices. So the same way we broke the Soviet Union in the 80s with low oil prices, now we're turning that around completely to raise prices against the Chinese. It's not just oil. It's iron ore, it's bauxite, all the kind of raw stuff that the Chinese buy in huge bulk, process it with cheap labor, and resell it abroad, generally at a loss. People don't realize that. The Chinese don't make a lot of money. But they have to do that. They're on a treadmill to keep their people employed. Okay, so oil is a key weapon here. And the object is not for us necessarily to own all the oil, but we just want to keep it away from the other guys and make them pay through the nose for it wherever they do get it. And Iraq is the key focal point for this because Iraq is the main source of additional barrels of oil on the planet right now. And the Chinese had targeted that for a long time. In fact, one of the points I make in this book that I wrote, it's called The Oil Card, is that the reason we invaded Iraq in 2003 had nothing to do with weapons of mass destruction.
Of course.
And I think everybody kind of realized that at the time. There was, turned out to be no evidence for the stuff that Colin Powell told the UN about. But I say the reason we attacked Iraq was because at the end of 2003, UN sanctions would have been lifted on that country, and they would have been free to sell their oil to anybody or to sell the oil in the ground to anybody. And the Chinese were all over Saddam. They were setting up all kinds of deals with him. They already had a bunch of them lined up ready to sign as soon as sanctions would have been lifted. George W. Bush ran out of time. There was no way to continue those sanctions. He couldn't do anything else, so he invaded the country. And it basically put the kibosh on all of those Chinese plans to basically take over and garrison those fields.
Why did the Chinese, though, James, allow us to do that? Why didn't they step in and say, no, 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 no?
At the time, they did raise all kinds of objections with the UN and so forth. But the fact is, they didn't have the ability to project power in a way that would stop us. We could just do it. We had the forces. We could go in and do it. They could cry all they wanted about it. They couldn't stop it. And they just had to sit back and take it. What they did then was to come back afterwards after the new government was put in place, run by this guy, Maliki, who went courting the Chinese because the Chinese had lots of money. The Chinese were eager to throw lots of money into Iraq to develop lots of old and underdeveloped oil fields they could get the oil. And so Maliki gave them a whole bunch of contracts to go in and develop the oil. Now, there's a difference between the contracts that Maliki and the post-war Iraq was doing than what Saddam was going to do. Saddam was going to actually sell the Chinese the equity ownership of the oil in the ground. In the oil business, that's the goal. You want to own the resource in the ground.
And I'm sure he was going to put the money in his own bank account.
Well, he was taking kickbacks every which way. I think Maliki's crew was probably doing the same thing. But there is a U.S. policy that's been in place since the early 80s that says quite specifically, if any foreign power moves to gain control of Middle Eastern oil reserves, the United States will regard that as a direct threat to our national security and will respond, if necessary, with military force. It's called the Carter Doctrine. It was originally designed to keep the Russians, keep their mitts off of Iran after the Iranian Revolution. But it's still in place. It's still on the books. And I think that's all of the justification George W. Bush needed to conduct that war,
Let's jump ahead, though, James. Now, let's jump ahead to where ISIS is right now. This very well-armed, well-equipped, well-financed group that really is taking Iraq by storm.
Right. And they're not doing it. These are not just a bunch of desert Bedouins who decided to get together and wage a war. This is a highly organized, well-trained and equipped, disciplined military force that came out of nowhere. My view of the thing is clearly that this is a Western-backed entity, particularly funded through the Saudis, probably the Turks, the Qataris, but clearly with U.S. and Western impetus to basically go in and destabilize Iraq. Because what happened, I think, when the Obama administration basically lost control of Iraq to the Maliki faction, which got aligned with the Iranians, of all people. And Obama just kind of bugged out. He pulled the troops out, and we just let the place go.
He basically said, that's it, we're out of there.
Yeah, and so what happened was the Chinese came in like mad, and they bought into a bunch of these oil fields with these, they weren't ownership contracts, they were service contracts. Now, they're not as profitable for the Chinese, but still, the Chinese end up with the oil.
But let me ask you, we're bombing them as we speak, so how could we be backing them?
Well, no. Who are we bombing? This is where it gets very murky, but this is the way the world works. We don't want our own fingerprints on this thing, so we create this other entity, this ISIS group, which probably half or more of these people are madmen. I don't know, but they are doing the job. They are going in. They've basically taken over a third of Iraq. They could threaten the rest of the country, but the net effect is exactly what we had in mind when we invaded the country to begin with, namely leave Iraq as a crippled, divided state, unable to marshal the resources to produce all that oil. And that's where we're headed now. We've created a new country for the Kurds in the top of Iraq. You've got ISIS, which has taken over the middle chunk of it and threatens the lower part where the Chinese are. And it's basically pushed overall Iraq oil production down again. I mean, the Iraqis have struggled ever since that war, 10 to 11 years now, to try and get their oil production back up. It had just recently gotten back to where it was during Saddam's time. And all the projections were it was going to rapidly move up now. Iraq is already the second largest producer in OPEC behind Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is like 10 million barrels a day. Iraq had been doing like 3 million. Now it's down to 2.5. It's probably going to go to 2. Production is going to fall there. And who gets hurt? It's going to be the Chinese, because they've put in tens and tens of billions of dollars to develop these fields. They're just getting to the point where they're able to get some oil out of it to recover their costs. And it may not happen. I mean, ISIS could move in there, disrupt the production, take over the fields altogether. The Chinese could be completely out of luck there. And it's a precarious situation for them, really.
Why do we want to disrupt the Chinese, our biggest debt holder? Why would we want to do that?
Because eventually the Chinese are going to be a military force.
Right. Sooner than later. Sooner than later.
Yeah, that's right. I think so. And, you know, the debt thing, we can go into that. That Chinese, them holding our treasury debt is not what it looks like. It's not like they're our friends for doing that. We hate them for that because it's a currency manipulation thing. Well, we could talk about that later. But the point is, we don't want them comfortably settling into Iraq and controlling that oil. And the way to do it is basically we got rid of Maliki. All of the talks for a new government there have broken down again. ISIS is there in force, threatening the rest of the country. Now, we have done some bombing, but where was it? It was up in the north to keep ISIS from encroaching too far on the Kurds. We want the Kurds there. You know, we like those guys. We're going to keep them there. They've got a little bit of oil. That's fine. But ISIS, you know, there's a big controversy, a big mystery. Who are these guys?
Yeah, I thought they were Saddam's military that took off their uniforms and ran for the hills when we went in there in 2003. But those weren't well-trained soldiers. I mean, these guys are.
They're very well-trained. They're very well-disciplined. In fact, some of the military analysis I've seen give these guys very high marks. You know, when they get bombed, they don't just run away like Saddam's guys. They strategically withdraw, and then they mine the roads, and, you know, they do everything right, and which is why the Maliki crew in Baghdad, even with Iranian special forces, some of the best of the Iranian army has been sent in there to try and push these guys back. They're not making any headway. But the question is, who's behind these guys? And again, clearly there's been a Saudi assistance to these guys from an early time. I think we've encouraged that.
I think the Saudis, too, bought them off to just basically say, hands off here.
Well, it's more than that. I think the Saudis benefit greatly by keeping Iraq busted up and restricting Iraqi production, because every barrel that gets bought from Iraq doesn't get bought from Saudi Arabia. So, it's a way for the Saudis to beat up on their prime competitor here. At the same time, there's a question. Cui bono? Who benefits? Who is benefiting from this? Who's hurting? ISIS is attacking only two countries, Iraq and Syria, which just happen to be the people that we'd like to see regime changed as well. Coincidence? They're not going after Turkey. They're not going after Jordan. They're not going after Saudi Arabia. They've really focused their assault to create this new mystery state that they're talking about here. And Obama has done nothing to stop them. Now, it makes him look weak, but frankly, this is exactly the game plan. It's exactly the game plan you would expect if the United States were supporting these guys and using them to accomplish this purpose. And I think, actually, while the United States publicly looks like we're just bumbling along and inept and weak, in fact, we're playing our cards pretty well here, frankly. It's taken some time to play out, but you don't see any U.S. troops on the ground there. It's accomplishing the purpose, and we're probably going to end up bumping off the Assad regime as well. I mean, when ISIS gets rolling here, they're not going to stop. They'll just remove Assad. I think or limit his regime so that he'll be powerless anyway. So we're going to kill two birds with one stone here.
And we but aren't they supposed to be bombing? Yeah, that was one of my stories tonight. They're going to bomb the Syria. Assad's going ballistic on that. But they want to take out ISIS in Syria, too, or not. So what's the story there, James?
Well, that's the thing. We haven't bombed anybody in Syria yet. We're flying some drones over there, collecting intelligence, and supposedly giving some of it to Assad. Assad doesn't have the forces or the ability to combat ISIS anyway. We're just kind of sitting there watching ISIS steamroller into Syria. And so if we drop a few bombs somewhere, I mean, it's not going to stop ISIS. And who knows what we're really doing in Syria anyway. We may be helping out ISIS. ISIS, these guys, they just took over a major Syrian air base and grabbed a whole bunch of sophisticated weapons. And
yeah, that's what they're doing.
These are not desert Bedouins who just decided to go, you know, shoot up a town somewhere. They've got serious plans in mind. They've got capabilities. They're well-armed and trained. So
I don't know, James. I'm confused because, I mean, they take over a dam in Iraq, and we bomb them away. It's bizarre.
Well, what we bombed was, I think they had some mortar positions that were shelling the Kurds. We didn't like that. I think the ISIS guys probably got carried away. They said, hey, we're on a roll. Let's go. We can go all the way north here, too.
Let's take everything.
So this is the thing. When you create these kind of mad dog entities, you know, sometimes you got to whack them with a newspaper to make them lay down. You know, it's you don't have complete control of them. They take on a life of their own. In fact, there's a big question. Where does the continuing funding come for these guys? Some people think, well, they robbed a bank in Mosul. I don't think that's enough to do it.
Yeah,
they captured a couple of oil fields, but it's just not enough money to pay for all of this stuff, the weapons, the people. They've got to be funded.
And where are the bank accounts? Why aren't they seized?
Yeah, exactly. Right. I mean, the U.S. could freeze anybody's bank account in the world. I mean, half of Putin's government, I think, has been put in a freeze mode by our sanctions. So surely we could do it with any of these other guys. But that's why I'm saying that it just cries out that this ISIS group has either that, at least the silent and possibly the overt support of the U.S. and the West through the Saudis and Turks and other countries like that. And it's accomplishing exactly the purpose that I lay out here, that basically we want Iraq crippled. We don't want their oil out of the ground. We want to keep that oil on the ground, and we especially don't want the Chinese to own it.
We want to own it or control it and just keep it there as long as we can.
Right. We don't want it. We don't want to look like we own it. We just don't want the other guys to get it. That's the point here. And if we can just destabilize that country long enough, you know, that's what's going to happen. That oil, their production is going to sink again. Their pipelines are going to get blown up. They won't be able to get the stuff to the market. What's not to like?
Well, you know what? One would say better we have it and control it than them, I guess.
Well, you know, U.S. companies have had a chance to go in there and negotiate for these contracts to do it. And ExxonMobil's in there, BP's in there running a big field. Some other country, Marathon is up there in the north of Iraq doing some stuff. The Kurds actually offer better deals on the oil than the Maliki government. Because the way these service contracts work.
Hold on for a second, James. Hold on for a second. We're at the break. So hold on, and I'll be right back.